The Soviet space program had always been a mystery to those outside the Soviet Union. NASA and the Western intelligence agencies were always reduced to small snippets of information gleaned from newspapers and technical journals, perhaps a few errant whispers collected from human sources on the ground, to keep abreast of what the Soviets were up to at any given time. But after the death of Sergei Kurilyov, even despite the many challenges of collecting reliable intelligence on the Soviet space program, a singular truth was growing apparent. The loss of Kurilyov had dealt a terrible blow to the project. Their moon rocket and their lander were falling behind. The resources required for a lunar landing were not forthcoming from the government, and even despite the awe-inspiring feats the Soviets had pulled off early in the space race, that momentum was mostly gone. America was surging ahead, while the Soviets were slipping further and further behind. Welcome to episode 36 of Frontier of Infinity, Aftermath. In the last episode, we reached the final mission of Project Gemini, which saw James Lovell and Buzz Aldrin finally pull off a series of successful spacewalks, proving that such a thing could be done efficiently and safely. It was a major victory for NASA, and was a fine way to send off their second crewed spaceflight program. The way forward for Project Apollo was finally cleared, and it was there that NASA would sink their efforts next. But before we move on to Apollo, we're going to take a step back and shift our focus across the world to the Soviet Union, where we'll pick up where we last left the Soviet space program. In January of 1966, they lost their chief designer, the man who had led them to dominate the space race for most of its run, Sergei Kurilyov. He was scheduled for a fairly routine surgery to address an abdominal problem, but complications during the procedure were compounded by his increasingly poor health, due in part to his brutal treatment at the hands of the Soviet state as a prisoner in the Gulag system. He died on the table, despite his surgeon's best efforts to save him, and the Soviets were deprived of their greatest rocketeer in an instant. The death of Kurilyov sent shockwaves rippling through the Soviet space program, the military, and the Soviet Union at large. It is there, amidst the chaos which followed Kurilyov's death, that we pick up today. Before he had departed for the hospital for his surgery, Kurilyov had left a longtime colleague of his in charge of the space program in his absence, Vasily Mishin. It didn't take long for Mishin to be put forward as a candidate to take over for Kurilyov permanently, accepting the weighty title of chief designer. Kurilyov was legendary among the Soviet engineers, and with good reason. Anyone familiar with the basic history of the Soviet space program, or anyone who is a regular listener of this show, will know that he had an uncanny ability to pull off unbelievable feats of engineering under terrible working conditions, and with greatly limited resources at his disposal. This was the man who had placed the first artificial satellite, dog, and human into orbit. His stature was enormous, and his absence left a palpable vacuum in the program. Who could possibly be qualified to replace him? Some voices among the senior personnel at OKB-1, Kurilyov's design bureau, suggested that Mishin was their man. After all, had Kurilyov not seemingly chosen him to be his successor? Mishin was a fantastic engineer. No one doubted that. But there were concerns that he would fall short of the job in the other, less scientific capacities it required. The chief designer was not only an engineer, but also a politician, manager, and visionary, among other things. Kurilyov had juggled all of this and more, but there was ample skepticism that Mishin would be able to do the same. Mishin was 49 years old at the time, and he had served as Kurilyov's right-hand man for most of his tenure as chief designer. He was born in 1917, the very same year that the Bolsheviks gained control of Russia and gave rise to the Soviet Union. But Mishin was never politically active, instead pouring his energies into studying mathematics while he attended the Moscow Aviation Institute. He was spared the horrors of the gulags, unlike Kurilyov, and was allowed to work on aircraft design during the Second World War. He worked on early jet projects after the war, and then was inducted into the Soviet space program as it began to gestate in the early years of the nuclear age. He quickly rose to become Kurilyov's deputy, working on the Sputnik projects as well as the other early Soviet efforts in space. He had been a useful asset for Kurilyov's organization, but now he was chosen to lead it in the chief designer's absence, even despite the doubts which harried him. Luckily for historians, Mishin kept detailed journals about his experiences, granting us a candid look into his thoughts and motivations while working on space projects. They form an invaluable resource when attempting to peel back the Iron Curtain and gain a glimpse into the complex machinery which governed the Soviet space program. The workload which Kurilyov had left behind was enormous. The Soyuz and N-1 projects were both underway, but they had a long way to go. There was design, construction, and testing which had to be organized, scheduled, and completed. Both vehicles were brand new and entirely experimental. Mishin himself summed up the main objectives for the Soviet space program, which remained to be completed after Kurilyov's death, in a memoir he wrote in the 1990s. First, the Soviets needed to develop orbital docking capability, as well as the ability to transfer cosmonauts from one spacecraft to another. They needed to be able to pull off a circumlunar flight as well, planned to be done with the UR-500 rocket with cosmonauts on board, which would require a great deal of development and ground testing to be carried out first. And finally, the N-1 moon rocket had to be completed, tested, and made ready to fly with the Soyuz capsule. Those two spacecraft were expected to carry out a vastly more complex mission than any the Soviets had ever attempted previously, landing a single cosmonaut on the moon and then returning him to the Earth alive. To make matters even worse for Mishin, he was still expected to be racing the Americans, who were enjoying an unprecedented streak of victories with the middle missions of the Gemini program. But that still wasn't all. There were other space projects underway which needed to be tended to. Most notably, there was the Molnaya Communications Satellite Program, which was experiencing issues of its own. To top all of this off, the personnel who made up the Soviet space program were largely demoralized in the wake of Kurilyov's death. He had been their leader through the best and worst of times, and to have him snatched away so suddenly and unexpectedly had sent spirits plummeting all throughout the program. Mishin would have to pull his people together and ensure that they did not lose hope in the face of such overwhelming work and long odds at beating the Americans. March 16, 1966, saw the successful flight of Gemini 8, on which Dave Scott and Neil Armstrong successfully docked their Gemini capsule with an Agena target. They also nearly died when their spacecraft began to uncontrollably spin, but Armstrong and Scott both stayed cool and fixed the problem before it could turn lethal. It was a huge boost for NASA, and a fresh blow to the Soviets. The issue was exacerbated 11 days later when a Molnaya satellite test failed. But Mishin kept on. He continued to work on the N-1 and the Soyuz, fighting tooth and nail every step of the way to get the resources he needed from the Soviet authorities. He didn't have the money he needed to construct test stands for the enormous 30-engine first stage, a limitation which severely inhibited his ability to carry out necessary testing. The N-1 first stage contained more individual rocket engines than any rocket stage previously constructed. Any differentiation in thrust among those many motors could cause a rocket to lose control and heel over in the air. Coordinating all of them was of paramount importance, and to make sure that such a thing could be done required adequate ground testing. While the perennial battle for funds carried on, Mishan was facing engineering challenges for the N1 as well. He was having difficulty achieving a maximum payload of 95 tons as Kurilyov had envisioned, necessitating the rocket to be lightened and the thrust output for the engines to be increased. These issues required the addition of another stabilizer, further complicating the design, and still, there was no way to test it in a satisfactory manner. While juggling all of this, Mishan was also still at work on the Voskhod program. I erroneously stated that the Voskhod program ended after the flight of Voskhod 2 in an earlier episode. What I should have specified was that the manned flights of the Voskhod ended after that second mission. There were more Voskhods to fly, though none of them carried humans. They were used for testing some of the onboard systems which were planned to be used or iterated upon for the Soyuz, including the life support systems. Mishan fired off a Voskhod mission with a pair of dogs as a crew who were left in space for 22 days before they were returned safely to the surface. But the medical results returned by the canine explorers were not promising. Their circulatory systems were affected by such a long stint in space and did not return to normal until several days were spent back on land. Their muscular systems were atrophied and they were quite dehydrated. These results unnerved Mishan, and he declared that there would be no further human-crewed flights until Soyuz was ready to fly. While the Americans continued to fire off mission after mission throughout the remainder of 1966, not a single crewed Soviet mission flew. Instead, labor continued on the ground, working on the N1, the Soyuz, and the mission plans which were hoped to beat the Americans to the moon. Though the prospect of actually doing so dimmed with each passing day and each mounting victory for NASA. There were, however, a number of robotic missions. Before his death, Kurilyov had passed responsibility for automated exploration off to a separate design bureau, often referred to as the Lavochkin Design Bureau after its former head designer, even though he was dead before the bureau began to work on interplanetary probes. This design group was then led by Georgi Babakin, and they had been at work on the next line of Luna probes. In early 1966, Luna 9 was ready to fly. It was launched from Baikonur on January 31st of that year, and by February 3rd, it reached the moon and executed a soft landing on the lunar surface. This was a major milestone for the Soviets, and the probe reported back to Earth that the surface of the moon was plenty solid enough to support the weight of a lander. The lander itself took the shape of a rough sphere, the outer shell of which opened up into four flower petal-shaped flaps on landing. Spring-loaded antennae and apparatus deployed automatically, and the vessel's scientific equipment could get to work. A photographic analysis of the landing area in the Mare Procellarum was undertaken, and radiological equipment measured an average radiation dosage of about 30 millirads per day on the surface. It continued to function for 3 days before its batteries died on the 6th of February and the spacecraft ceased to function. It was not the same as docking two spacecraft in orbit or achieving a flawless orbital rendezvous, but it was a nearly perfect mission all the same, and delivered a much-needed victory to the Soviets during one of their darkest hours. In March, Luna 10 took flight with a very different mission from its predecessor. Rather than land on the moon, it would circle around it, falling into a stable orbit. It was a longer, roughly cylindrical spacecraft, as opposed to the spherical design of Luna 9. It carried an arsenal of 7 scientific instruments, including radiological equipment, a micrometeoroid detector, and sensors for picking up infrared and X-ray radiation. The first attempt of this mission, launched on March 1st, failed to leave Earth orbit, but later in the month it was attempted again and flew successfully. It orbited the moon for 56 days and detected a distorted gravitational force from the moon itself, indicating that there may have been an uneven distribution of mass inside the moon. The Communist Party Congress happened to meet while Luna 10 was in orbit, and on the morning of April 4th, a piece of music called the Internationale was piped into the meeting chamber, allegedly broadcast live from the spacecraft as it made its way around the moon. However, this was artifice, as it was later determined that the broadcast was a recording from Luna 10, used because the mission controllers did not trust the spacecraft to reliably broadcast live. A concern compounded by the fact that during a test run of the broadcast, the solid-state oscillators on board, which would reproduce the song, had dropped a note. Rather than risk embarrassment before 5,000 members of the Communist Party, they opted for a safer route. A deception which would not be discovered for 30 years. As Mishin continued to toil on the ground, and the Lavochkin Bureau delivered meager victories with Luna, the public relations war raged on. In July, cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov delivered an optimistic message to the international press, declaring that the Soviets were in fact on track to beat the Americans to the moon by a full year. He stated, quote, "There is no need to hurry with a manned moon trip. The important thing is to carry out everything safely. But I can positively state that the Soviet Union will not be beaten by the United States in the race for a human being to go to the moon." End quote. I can't say what effect this had on Mishin. Perhaps it buoyed his spirits. Perhaps it ramped up the incredible pressure he was already under. But no matter the case for Mishin personally, the space race was still very much on, even if the ultimate result was becoming increasingly inevitable. Luna 11 flew shortly thereafter in August. It made its way to the moon, where it fell into an orbit, but failed to orient itself properly to take pictures of the surface. It returned a number of images of empty space, and while it returned data, it was nothing like the success of Lunas 9 and 10. A fault investigation was conducted to determine what caused the orientation failure, and it was determined that it was most likely the result of a dislodged part in the attitude control system. The machine was redesigned to compensate, and then Luna 12 was fired off in October 1966. It was able to orient itself properly for photography, but its UV spectrometer failed. Regardless, it continued to operate, and eventually spiraled down into the moon sometime in 1967. The very next month after the launch of Luna 12, a commission headed by Mstislav Keldysh approved a new draft for the N1L3 project, the official designation for the N1 Soyuz project, which had been written by Mishin. In February of the following year, Dmitry Ustinov, the Central Committee secretary, granted Mishin official permission to continue work on the program. However, the document itself which gave this permission was titled On the Progress of the Work on the Development of the UR-500K-L1. UR-500K-L1 referred to the plan to use Vladimir Chelomey's UR-500 rocket design to send a Soviet crew around the moon rather than onto it. Historian James Harford suggests that this may have been a tacit admission from the Soviet leadership that a lunar landing was not entirely tenable. Perhaps Mishin should instead focus on circling around the moon with a Soviet crew rather than attempt a full landing. It would be easier to beat the Americans to circling the moon rather than landing on it. The document also laid out a wholly unrealistic timeline for the lunar lander program, expecting a successful landing to be made in early 1969 in time to beat the Americans. Regardless of what Ustinov was trying to communicate to Mishin, the Americans were beginning to grow wise to the Soviet designers' troubles. The U.S. intelligence apparatus had been collecting what they could on the progress of the moon program, and a national intelligence estimate from March of 1967 summed the situation as such, quote, "Several factors militate against their ability to compete with the Apollo timetable as originally planned," end quote. The estimate went on to explain that the first stage of the N1 would likely not be ready to fly until 1968, and then an additional year of testing would be required to ensure that it was reliable enough to carry a crew. They would also need to develop many of the skills NASA had already picked up, like orbital rendezvous and docking. The American intelligence community were absolutely right in their assessment. The Soviets were foundering, and it became apparent to nearly all in the know that there was no realistic hope for beating Apollo to the moon's surface. But just maybe there was still a chance they could beat the Americans to orbiting a crew around the moon. Their best hope for that lay in the UR-500 and the L-1 capsule, which was swiftly redesigned to accommodate as quick an orbital mission as could be assembled. It was the Soviets' last hope in the space race. We'll leave off there for now, with Mishin struggling to hand the Soviets victory enough to save face, while the Americans are beginning to comprehend just how large NASA's lead has become. When we meet next, we'll track the progress made on Project Apollo while Project Gemini was underway. That should catch us up with the Soviets, and then we'll be free to move on to the final stage of the space race, where the two global superpowers will face off in a final contest to conquer the moon. As always, thanks to all of you for listening. If you like this show and you want to help me out, please follow the podcast, share it with your friends and family, and leave it a rating if you feel so inclined. It really does help. Our theme music is Crossing the Universe by Esther Garcia. You can listen to the full track and more of her music on Spotify. Until next time, I'm Tom. This is Frontier of Infinity. I'll see you among the stars.